For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Episode 7 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. Read by Mark Nelson. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 7. The mockers were fresh meat, but they accepted the humans with such friendliness and trust that Barber lost all his desire to have one for supper or for any other time. They had a limited supply of dried meat, and there would be plenty of orange corn. They would not go hungry. They discovered that the mockers had living quarters in both the cool caves and the ones warmed by the hot springs. There was evidence that they hibernated during the winters in the warm caves. There were no minerals in the Mockers' Valley, and they set out to continue their circuit of the chasm. They did not get far until the heat had become so great that the chasm's tributaries began going dry. They turned back then to wade in the little valley until the fall rains came. When the long summer was ended by the first rain, they resumed their journey. They took a supply of the orange corn and two of the mockers, the yellow one and its mate. The other mockers watched them leave, standing silent and solemn in front of their caves, as though they feared they might never see their two fellows or the humans again. The two mockers were pleasant company, riding on their shoulders and chattering any nonsense that came to mind, and sometimes saying things that were not at all nonsense, making Humboldt wonder if mockers could partly read human minds and dimly understand the meaning of some of the things they said. They found a place where saltpeter was very thinly and erratically distributed. They scraped off all the films of it that were visible and procured a small amount. They completed their circuit and reached the foot of the long, steep slope of the crags without finding anything more. It was an awesome climb that lay before them, up a grade so steep and barred with so many low ledges that when their legs refused to carry them farther, they crawled. The heat was still very serious, and there would be no water until they came to the spring beyond the mountain summit. A burning wind, borne on the blazing floor of the chasm, followed them up the mountain all day. Their leather canteens were almost dry when night came, and they were no more than a third of the way up to the top. The mockers had become silent as the elevation increased, and when they stopped for the night, Humboldt saw that they would never live to cross the mountain. They were breathing fast, their hearts racing, as they tried to extract enough oxygen from the thin air. They drank a few drops of water, but they would not touch the corn he offered them. The white mocker died at mid-morning the next day, as they stopped for a rest. The yellow one crawled feebly to her side and died a few minutes later. "So, that's that," Humboldt said, looking down at them. "The only things on Ragnarok that ever trusted us and wanted to be our friends, and we killed them." They drank the last of their water and went on. They made dry camp that night, and dreams of cold streams of water tormented their exhausted sleep. The next day was a hellish eternity in which they walked and fell and crawled and walked and fell again. Barber weakened steadily, his breathing growing to a rattling panting. He spoke once that afternoon, to try to smile with dry, swollen lips and say between his panting gasps, "It would be hell to have to die so thirsty like this." After that he fell with increasing frequency, each time slower and weaker in getting up again. Half a mile short of the summit, he fell for the last time. He tried to get up, failed, and tried to crawl. He failed at that, too, and collapsed face down in the rocky soil. Humboldt went to him and said between his own labored intakes of breath, "Wait, Dan, I'll go on, bring you back water." Barber raised himself with a great effort and looked up. "No use," he said. "My heart, too much." He fell forward again, and that time he was very still, his desperate panting no more. It seemed to Humboldt that it was half a lifetime later that he finally reached the spring and the cold, clear water. He drank the most ecstatic pleasure he had ever experienced in his life. Then the pleasure drained away, as he seemed to see Dan Barber trying to smile, and seemed to hear him say, "It would be hell to have to die so thirsty like this." He rested for 2 days before he was in condition to continue on his way. He reached the plateau and saw that the woods goats had been migrating south for some time. On the second morning he climbed up a gentle roll in the plain and met three unicorns face to face. They charged at once, squealing with anticipation. Had he been equipped with an ordinary bow, he would have been killed within seconds. But the automatic crossbow poured a rain of arrows into the faces of the unicorns that caused them to swing aside in pain and enraged astonishment. The moment they had swung enough to expose the area just behind their heads, the arrows became fatal. One unicorn escaped, three arrows bristling in its face. It watched him from a distance for a little while, squealing and shaking its head in baffled fury. Then it turned and disappeared over a swell in the plain, running like a deer. He resumed his southward march, hurrying faster than before. The unicorn had headed north, and that could be for but one purpose, to bring enough reinforcements to finish the job. He reached the caves at night. No one was up but George Ord, working late in his combination workshop laboratory. George looked up at the sound of his entrance and saw that he was alone. "So, Dan didn't make it?" he asked. "The chasm got him," he answered. And then, wearily, "The chasm. We found the damn thing." "The red stratum?" "It was only iron stains." "I made a little pilot smelter while you were gone," George said. "I was hoping the red stratum would be ore. The other prospecting parties, none of them found anything." "We'll try again next spring," he said. "We'll find it somewhere, no matter how long it takes." "Our time may not be so long. The observations show the sun to be farther south than ever." "Then we'll make double use of the time we do have. We'll cut the hunting parties to the limit and send out more prospecting parties. We're going to have a ship to meet the Gurns again." "Sometimes," George said, his black eyes studying him thoughtfully, "I think that's all you live for, Bill, the day when you can kill Gurns." George said it as a statement of fact, without censure, but Humboldt could not keep an edge of harshness out of his voice as he answered, "For as long as I'm leader, that's all we're going to live for." He followed the game south that fall, taking with him Bob Craig and young Anders. Hundreds of miles south of the caves they came to the lowlands, a land of much water and vegetation and vast herds of unicorns and woods goats. It was an exceedingly dangerous country due to the concentration of unicorns and prowlers, and only the automatic crossbows combined with never-ceasing vigilance enabled them to survive. There they saw the crawlers, hideous things that crawled on multiple legs like 3-ton centipedes, their mouths set with 6 mandibles and dripping a stinking saliva. The bite of a crawler was poisonous, instantly paralyzing even to a unicorn, though not instantly killing them. The crawlers ate their victims at once, however, ripping the helpless and still living flesh from its bones. Although the unicorns feared the crawlers, the prowlers hated them with a fanatical intensity, and made the use of their superior quickness to kill every crawler they found, ripping at the crawler until the crawler, in an insanity of rage, bit itself and died of its own poison. They had taken one of the powerful longbows with them, in addition to their crossbows, and they killed a crawler with it one day. As they did so, a band of 20 prowlers came suddenly upon them. 20 prowlers, with the advantage of surprise at short range, could have slaughtered them. Instead, the prowlers continued on their way without as much as a challenging snarl. Now why, Bob Craig wondered, did they do that? They saw we had just killed a crawler, Humboldt said. The crawlers are their enemies, and I guess letting us live was their way of showing appreciation. Their further explorations of the lowlands revealed no minerals, nothing but alluvial material of unknown depth, and there was no reason to stay longer except that return to the caves was impossible until spring came. They built attack-proof shelters in the trees and settled down to wait out the winter. They started north with the first wave of woods goats, nothing but lack of success to show for their months of time and effort. When they were almost to the caves, they came to the barren valley where the Gurns had herded the rejects out of the cruisers, and to the place where the stockade had been. It was a lonely place, the stockade walls fallen and scattered, and the graves of Humboldt's mother and all the others long since obliterated by the hooves of the Unicorn Legions. Bitter memories were reawakened, tinged by the years with nostalgia, and the stockade was far behind them before the dark mood left them. The orange corn was planted that spring, and the number of prospecting parties was doubled. The corn sprouted, grew feebly, and died before maturity. The prospecting parties returned one by one, each to report no success. He decided, that fall, that time was too precious to waste. They would have to use the alternate plan he had spoken of. He went to George Ord and asked him if it would be possible to build a hyperspace transmitter with the materials they had. "It's the one way we could have a chance to leave here without a ship of our own," he said. "By luring a Gurn cruiser here and then taking it away from them." George shook his head. "A hyperspace transmitter might be built, given enough years of time. But it would be useless without power. It would take a generator of such size that we'd have to melt down every gun, knife, axe, every piece of steel and iron we have. And then we'd be 500 pounds short. On top of that, we'd have to have at least 300 pounds more of copper for additional wire." "I didn't realize it would take such a large generator," he said after a silence. "I was sure we could have a transmitter." "Get me the metal, and we can," George said. He sighed restlessly, and there was almost hatred in his eyes as he looked at the enclosing walls of the cave. "You're not the only one who would like to leave our prison. Get me 800 pounds of copper and iron, and I'll make the transmitter, some way." 800 pounds of metal. On Ragnarok, that was like asking for the sun. The years went by, and each year there was the same determined effort, the same lack of success. And each year the suns were farther south, marking the coming of the end of any efforts other than the one to survive. In the year 30, when fall came earlier than ever before, he was forced to admit to himself the bleak and bitter fact. He and the others were not of the generation that would escape from Ragnarok. They were Earthborn. They were not adapted to Ragnarok, and could not scour a world of 1.5 gravity for metals that might not exist. And vengeance was a luxury he could not have. A question grew in his mind where there had been only his hatred for the Gurns before. What would become of the future generations on Ragnarok? With the question, a scene from his childhood kept coming back to him. A late summer evening in the first year on Ragnarok, and Julia sitting beside him in the warm starlight. "You're my son, Billy," she had said. "The first I ever had. Now, before so very long, maybe I'll have another one." Hesitantly, not wanting to believe, he had asked, "What some of them said about how you might die then. It won't really happen, will it, Julia?" "It might." Then her arm had gone around him, and she had said, "If I do, I'll leave in my place a life that's more important than mine ever was. Remember me, Billy, and this evening, and what I said to you, if you should ever be leader. Remember that it's only through the children that we can ever survive and whip this world. Protect them while they're small and helpless, and teach them to fight and be afraid of nothing when they're a little older. Never, never let them forget how they came to be on Ragnarok. Some day, even if it's 100 years from now, the Gurns will come again, and they must be ready to fight for their freedom and for their lives." He had been too young then to understand how truly she had spoken, and when he was old enough, his hatred for the Gurns had blinded him to everything but his own desires. Now he could see. The children of each generation would be better adapted to Ragnarok, and full adaptation would eventually come. But all the generations of the future would be potential slaves of the Gurn Empire, free only so long as they remained unnoticed. It was inconceivable that the Gurn should never pass by Ragnarok through all time to come. And when they finally came, the slow, uneventful progression of decades and centuries might have brought a false sense of security to the people of Ragnarok, might have turned the stories of what the Gurns did to the Rejects into legends, and then into myths that no one any longer believed. The Gurns would have to be brought to Ragnarok before that could happen. He went to George Ord again and said, "There's one kind of transmitter we could make a generator for, a plain, normal space transmitter, dot-dash, without a receiver." George laid down the diamond cutting wheel he had been working on. "It would take 200 years for the signal to get to Athena at the speed of light," he said. "Then, 40 days after it got there, a Gurn cruiser would come hell-bent to investigate." "I want the ones of the future to know that the Gurns will be here no later than 200 years from now, and with always the chance that a Gurn cruiser in space might pick up the signal at any time before then." "I see," George said. "The sword of Damocles hanging over their heads to make them remember." "You know what would happen to them if they ever forgot. You're as old as I am. You know what the Gurns did to us." "I'm older than you are," George said. "I was 9 when the Gurns left us here. They kept my father and mother, and my sister was only 3. I tried to keep her warm by holding her, but the hell fever got her that first night. She was too young to understand why I couldn't help her more." Hatred burned in his eyes at the memory, like some fire that had been banked but had never died. "Yes, I remember the Gurns and what they did. I wouldn't want it to have to happen to others. The transmitter will be made so that it won't." The guns were melted down, together with the other items of iron and steel, to make the castings for the generator. Ceramic pipes were made to carry water from the spring to a water wheel. the long, slow job of converting the miscellany of electronic devices, many of them broken, into the components of a transmitter proceeded. It was 5 years before the transmitter was ready for testing. It was early fall of the year 35 then, and the water that gushed from the pipe splashed in cold drops against Humboldt as the water wheel was set in motion. The generator began to hum, and George observed the output of it and the transmitter as registered by the various meters he had made. "Weak, but it will reach the Gurn monitor station on Athena," he said. "It's ready to send. What do you want to say?" "Make it something short," he said. "Make it Ragnarok calling." George poised his finger over the transmitting key. "This will set forces in motion that can never be recalled. What we do here this morning is going to cause a lot of Gurns, or Ragnarok people, to die." "It will be the Gurns who die," he said. "Send the signal." "Like you, I believe the same thing," George said. "I have to believe it, because that's the way I want it to be. I hope we're right. It's something we'll never know." He began depressing the key. A boy was given the job of operating the key, and the signal went out daily, until the freezing of winter stopped the water wheel that powered the generator. The sending of the signals was resumed when the spring came, and the prospecting parties continued their vain search for metals. The suns continued moving south, and each year the springs came later, the falls earlier. In the spring of 45, he saw that he would have to make his final decision. By then they had dwindled until they numbered only 68, the young ones gray and rapidly growing old. There was no longer any use to continue the prospecting. If any metals were to be found, they were at the north end of the plateau, where the snow no longer melted during the summer. They were too few to do more than prepare for what the old ones had feared they might have to face. Big winter. That would require the work of all of them. Sheets of mica were brought down from the crags, the summits of which were deeply buried under snow even in midsummer. Stoves were made of fire clay and mica, which would give both heat and light, and would be more efficient than the open fireplaces. The innermost caves were prepared for occupation, with multiple doors to hold out the cold, and with laboriously excavated ventilation ducts and smoke outlets. There were 60 of them in the fall of 50, when all had been done that could be done to prepare for what might come. "There aren't many of the Earthborn left now," Bob Crade said to him one night, as they sat in the flickering light of a stove. "And there hasn't been time for there to be many of the Ragnarok-born. The Gurns wouldn't get many slaves if they should come now." "They could use however many they found," he answered. "The younger ones, were the best adapted to this gravity, would be exceptionally strong and quick on a one-gravity world. There are dangerous jobs where a strong, quick slave is a lot more efficient and expendable than complex, expensive machines." "And they would want some specimens for scientific study," Jim Lake said. "They would want to cut into the young ones and see how they're built, that they're adapted to this one-and-a-half-gravity world." He smiled with the cold mirthlessness that always reminded Humboldt of his father, of the Lake who had been the Constellation's lieutenant commander. "According to the books, the Gurns never did try to make it a secret that when a Gurn doctor or biologist cuts into the muscles or organs of a non-Gurn to see what makes them tick, he wants them to be still alive and ticking as he does so." 17-year-old Don Chiara spoke, to say slowly, thoughtfully, "Slavery and vivisection. If the Gurn should come now, when there are so few of us, and if we should fight the best we could and lose, it would be better for whoever was the last of us left to put a knife in the hearts of the women and children than to let the Gurns have them. No one made any answer. There was no answer to make, no alternative to suggest. "In the future there will be more of us, and it will be different," he said at last. "On Earth the Gurns were always stronger and faster than humans, but when the Gurns come to Ragnarok they're going to find a race that isn't really human anymore. They're going to find a race before which they'll be like wood goats before prowlers." "If only they don't come too soon," Craig said. That was the chance that had to be taken, he replied. He wondered again as he spoke, as he had wondered so often in the past years, if he had given them all their death sentence when he ordered the transmitter built. Yet the future generations could not be permitted to forget, and steel could not be tempered without first thrusting it into the fire. He was the last of the young ones when he awoke one night in the fall of 56 and found himself burning with the hell fever. He did not summon any of the others. They could do nothing for him, and he had already done all he could for them. He had done all he could for them, and now he would leave 49 men, women, and children to face the unknown forces of Big Winter, while over them hung the sword he had forged, the increasing danger of detection by the Gurns. The question came again, sharp with the knowledge that it was far too late for him to change any of it. Did I arrange the execution of my people? Then, through the red haze of the fever, Julius spoke to him out of the past, sitting again beside him in the summer twilight, and saying, "Remember me, Billy, and this evening, and what I said to you. Teach them to fight, and be afraid of nothing. Never let them forget how they came to be on Ragnarok." She seemed very near and real, and the doubt faded and was gone. "Teach them to fight. Never let them forget." The men of Ragnarok were only fur-clad hunters who crouched in caves, but they would grow in numbers as time went by. Each generation would be stronger than the generation before it, and he had set forces in motion that would bring the last generation the trial of combat and the opportunity for freedom. How well they fought on that day would determine their destiny, but he was certain once again what that destiny would be. It would be to walk as conquerors before beaten and humbled Gurns. End of Episode 7. Episode 8 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 8. It was winter of the year 85, and the temperature was 106 degrees below zero. Walter Humboldt stood in front of the ice tunnel that led back through the glacier to the caves and looked up into the sky. It was noon, but there was no sun in the starlit sky. Many weeks before, the sun had slipped below the southern horizon. For a little while, a dim halo had marked its passage each day. Then that, too, had faded away. But now it was time for the halo to appear again, to herald the sun's returning. Frost filled the sky, making the stars flicker as it swirled endlessly downward. He blinked against it, his eyelashes trying to freeze to his lower eyelids at the movement, and turned to look at the north. There the northern lights were a gigantic curtain that filled a third of the sky, rippling and waving in folds that pulsated in red and green, rose and lavender and violet. Their reflection gleamed on the glacier that sloped down from the caves and glowed softly on the other glacier, the one that covered the transmitter station. The transmitter had long ago been taken into the caves, but the generator and water wheel were still there, frozen in a tomb of ice. For 3 years the glacier had been growing before the caves, and the plateau's southern face had been buried under snow for 10 years. Only a few woods goats ever came as far north as the country south of the caves, and they stayed only during the brief period between the last snow of spring and the first snow of fall. Their winter home was somewhere down near the equator. What had been called the southern lowlands was a frozen, lifeless waste. Once they had thought about going to the valley in the chasm where the mockers would be hibernating in their warm caves, but even if they could have gone up the plateau and performed the incredible feat of crossing the glacier-covered, blizzard-ripped crags, they would have found no food in the mockers' valley, only a little corn the mockers had stored away, which would soon have been exhausted. There was no place for them to live but in the caves or as nomads migrating with the animals. And if they migrated to the equator each year, they would have to leave behind them all the books and tools and everything that might some day have given them a civilized way of life and might some day have shown them how to escape from their prison. He looked again to the south, where the halo should be, thinking, "They should have made their decision in there by now. I'm their leader, but I can't force them to stay here against their will. I could only ask them to consider what it would mean if we left here." Snow creaked underfoot as he moved restlessly. He saw something lying under the blanket of frost and went to it. It was an arrow that someone had dropped. He picked it up, carefully, because the intense cold had made the shaft as brittle as glass. It would regain its normal strength when taken into the caves. There was the sound of steps, and Fred Schroeder came out of the tunnel, dressed as he was dressed in bulky furs. Schroeder looked to the south and said, "It seems to be starting to get a little lighter there." He saw that it was, a small, faint paling of the black sky. "They talked over what you and I told them," Schroeder said, "and about how we've struggled to stay here this long, and how, even if the sun should stop drifting south this year, it will be years of ice and cold at the caves before big spring comes. If we leave here, the glacier will cover the caves and fill them with ice," he said. "All we ever had will be buried back in there, and all we'll have left will be our bows and arrows and animal skins. We'll be taking a one-way road back into the Stone Age, for ourselves and our children and their children." "They know that," Schroeder said. "We both told them." He paused. They watched the sky to the south turn lighter. The northern lights flamed unnoticed behind them as the pale halo of the invisible sun slowly brightened to its maximum. Their faces were white with near freezing. Then they turned to go back into the caves. "They had made their decision," Schroeder went on. "I guess you and I did them an injustice when we thought they had lost their determination, when we thought they might want to hand their children a flint axe and say, 'Here, take this, and let it be the symbol of all you are or all you will ever be.' Their decision was unanimous. We'll stay for as long as it's possible for us to survive here." Howard Lake listened to teacher Morgan West read from the diary of Walter Humboldt, written during the terrible winter of 35 years before. "Each morning the light to the south was brighter. On the seventh morning we saw the sun, and it was not due until the eighth morning. It will be years before we can stop fighting the enclosure of the glacier, but we have reached and passed the dead of big winter. We have reached the bottom, and the only direction we can go in the future is up." "And so," West said, closing the book, "we are here in the caves tonight because of the stubbornness of Humboldt and Schroeder and all the others. Had they thought only of their own welfare, had they conceded defeat and gone into the migratory way of life, we would be sitting beside grass campfires somewhere to the south tonight, our way of life containing no plans or aspirations greater than to follow the game back and forth through the years. Now let's go outside to finish tonight's lesson. Teacher West led the way into the starlit night just outside the caves, Howard Lake and the other children following him. West pointed to the sky, where the star group they called the Athena constellation blazed like a huge arrowhead high in the east. "There," he said, "beyond the top of the arrowhead is where we were going when the Gurn stopped us 120 years ago and left us to die on Ragnarok. It's so far that Athena's sun can't be seen from here, so far that it will be another 115 years before our first signal gets there. Why is it, then, that you and all the other groups of children have to learn such things as history, physics, the Gurn language, and the way to fire a Gurn blaster?" The hand of every child went up. West selected 8-year-old Clifton Humboldt. "Tell us, Clifton," he said. "Because," Clifton answered, "a Gurn cruiser might pass by a few light years out at any time and pick up our signals. So we have to know all we can about them and how to fight them, because there aren't very many of us yet." "The Gurns will come to kill us," little Marie Chiara said, her dark eyes large and earnest. "They'll come to kill us and to make slaves out of the ones they don't kill, like they did with the others a long time ago. They're awful mean and awful smart, and we have to be smarter than they are." Howard looked again at the Athena constellation, thinking, "I hope they come just as soon as I'm old enough to fight them, or even tonight." "Teacher," he asked, "how would a Gurn cruiser look if it came tonight? Would it come from the Athena arrowhead?" "It probably would," West answered. "You would see its rocket blast, like a bright trail of fire." A bright trail of fire burst suddenly into being, coming from the constellation of Athena and lighting up the woods and hills and their startled faces as it arced down toward them. "It's them!" a treble voice exclaimed, and there was a quick flurry of movement as Howard and the other older children shoved the younger children behind them. Then the light vanished, leaving a dimmer glow where it had been. "Only a meteor," West said. He looked at the line of older children who were standing protectingly in front of the younger ones, rocks in their hands with which to ward off the Gurns, and he smiled in the way he had when he was pleased with them. Howard watched the meteor trail fade swiftly into invisibility and felt his heart beat slow from the first wild thrill to gray disappointment. Only a meteor. But someday he might be leader, and by then, surely, the Gurns would come. If not, he would find some way to make them come. 10 years later, Howard Lake was leader. There were 350 of them then, and Big Spring was on its way to becoming Big Summer. The snow was gone from the southern end of the plateau, and once again game migrated up the valleys east of the caves. There were many things to be done now that Big Winter was past, and they could have the chance to do them. They needed a larger pottery kiln, a larger workshop and a wooden lathe, more diamonds to make cutting wheels, more quartz crystals to make binoculars and microscopes. They could again explore the field of inorganic chemistry, even though results in the past had produced nothing of value, and they could, within a few years, resume the metal prospecting up the plateau, the most important project of all. Their weapons seemed to be as perfect as was possible, but when the Gurns came, they would need some quick and certain means of communication between the various units that would fight the Gurns. A leader who could not communicate with his forces and coordinate their actions would be helpless. And they had on Ragnarok a form of communication, if trained, that the Gurns could not detect or interfere with electronically. The Mockers. The crags were still white and impassable with snow that summer, but the snow was receding higher each year. 5 years later, in the summer of 135, the crags were passable for a few weeks. Lake led a party of 8 over them and down into the chasm. They took with them two small cages, constructed of wood and glass and made airtight with the strong Medusa bush glue. Each cage was equipped with a simple air pump and a pressure gauge. They brought back two pairs of mockers, as interested and trusting captives, together with a supply of the orange corn and a large amount of diamonds. The mockers, in their pressure-maintained cages, were not even aware of the increase in elevation as they were carried over the high summit of the crags. To Lake and the men with him, the climb back up the long, steep slope of the mountain was a stiff climb to make in one day, but no more than that. It was hard to believe that it had taken Humboldt and Barber almost 3 days to climb it, and that Barber had died in the attempt. It reminded him of the old crossbows that Humboldt and the others had used. They were thin, with a light pull, such as the present generation boys used. It must have required courage for the old ones to dare unicorn attacks, with bows so thin that only the small area behind the unicorn's jaws was vulnerable to their arrows. When the caves were reached, a very gradual reduction of pressure in the mocker cages was started, one that would cover a period of weeks. One pair of mockers survived and had two young ones that fall. The young mockers, like the first generation of Ragnarok-born children of many years before, were more adapted to their environment than their parents were. The orange corn was planted, using an adaptation method somewhat similar to that used with the mockers. It might have worked had the orange corn not required such a long period of time in which to reach maturity. When winter came, only a few grains had formed. They were saved for next year's seeds, to continue the slow adaptation process. By the fifth year, the youngest generation of mockers was well adapted to the elevation of the caves, but for a susceptibility to a quickly fatal form of pneumonia, which made it necessary to keep them from exposing themselves to the cold or to any sudden changes of temperature. Their intelligence was surprising, and they seemed to be partially receptive to human thoughts, as Bill Humboldt had written. By the end of the 15th year, their training had reached such a stage of perfection that a mocker would transmit or not transmit with only the unspoken thought of its master to tell it which it should be. In addition, they would transmit the message to whichever mocker their master's thought directed. Presumably, all mockers received the message, but only the mocker to whom it was addressed would repeat it aloud. They had their method of communication. They had their automatic crossbows for quick, close fighting, and their long-range longbows. They were fully adapted to the 1.5 gravity, and their reflexes were almost like those of prowlers. Ragnarok had long ago separated the quick from the dead. There were 819 of them that year, in the early spring of 150, and they were ready and impatient for the coming of the Gurns. Then the transmitter, which had been in operation again for many years, failed one day. George Craig had finished checking it when Lake arrived. He looked up from his instruments, remarkably similar in appearance to a sketch of the old George Ord, a resemblance that had been passed down to him by his mother, and said, "The entire circuit is either gone or ready to go. It's already operated for a lot longer than it should have." "It doesn't matter," Lake said. "It served its purpose. We won't rebuild it." George watched him questioningly. "It served its purpose," he said again. "It didn't let us forget that the Gurns will come again. But that isn't enough now. The first signal won't reach Athena until the year 235. It will be the dead of big winter again then. They'll have to fight the Gurns with bows and arrows that the cold will make as brittle as glass. They won't have a chance." "No," George said, "they won't have a chance. But what can we do to change it?" "It's something I've been thinking about," he said. "We'll build a hyperspace transmitter and bring the Gurns before big winter comes." "We will?" George asked, lifting his dark eyebrows. "And what do we use for the 300 pounds of copper and 500 pounds of iron we would have to make the generator?" "Surely we can find 500 pounds of iron somewhere on Ragnarok. The north end of the plateau might be the best bet. As for the copper, I doubt that we'll ever find it. But there are seams of a bauxite-like clay in the western hills. They're certain to contain aluminum, to at least some extent, so we'll make the wires of aluminum." "The ore would have to be refined to pure aluminum oxide before it could be smelted," George said. "And you can't smelt aluminum ore in an ordinary furnace. Only in an electric furnace with a generator that can supply a high amperage. And we would have to have cryolite ore to serve as the solvent in the smelting process." "There's a seam of cryolite in the eastern hills, according to the old maps," said Lake. "We could make a larger generator by melting down everything we have. It wouldn't be big enough to power the hyperspace transmitter, but it should be big enough to smelt aluminum ore." George considered the idea. "I think we can do it." "How long until we can send the signal?" he asked. "Given the extra metal we need, the building of the generator is a simple job. The transmitter is what will take years, maybe as long as 50." 50 years. "Can't anything be done to make it sooner?" he asked. "I know," George said. "You would like for the Gurns to come while you're still here. So would every man on Ragnarok. But even on Earth, the building of a hyperspace transmitter was a long, slow job, with all the materials they needed and all the special tools and equipment. Here we'll have to do everything by hand, and for materials we have only broken and burned out odds and ends. It will take about 50 years. It can't be helped." 50 years. But that would bring the Gurns before Big Winter came again. And there was the rapidly increasing chance that a Gurn cruiser would at any day intercept the first signals. They were already more than halfway to Athena. "Melt down the generator," he said. "Start making a bigger one. Tomorrow men will go out after bauxite and cryolite, and four of us will go up the plateau to look for iron." Lake selected Jean Taylor, Tony Chiara, and Steve Schroeder to go with him. They were well on their way by daylight the next morning, on the shoulder of each of them a mocker which observed the activity and new scenes with bright, interested eyes. They traveled light, since they would have fresh meat all the way, and carried herbs and corn only for the mockers. Once, generations before, it had been necessary for men to eat herbs to prevent deficiency diseases, but now the deficiency diseases, like hell fever, were unknown to them. They carried no compasses, since the radiations of the two suns constantly created magnetic storms that caused compass needles to swing as much as 20 degrees within an hour. Each of them carried a pair of powerful binoculars, however, binoculars that had been diamond-carved from the ivory-like black unicorn horn and set with lenses and prisms of diamond-cut quartz. The foremost bands of woods goats followed the advance of spring up the plateau, and they followed the woods goats. They could not go ahead of the goats. The goats were already pressing close behind the melting of the snow. No hills or ridges were seen as the weeks went by, and it seemed to Lake that they would walk forever across the endless rolling floor of the plain. Early summer came, and they walked across a land that was green and pleasantly cool at a time when the vegetation around the caves would be burned brown and lifeless. The woods goats grew less in number then, as some of them stopped for the rest of the summer in their chosen latitudes. They continued on, and at last they saw, far to the north, what seemed to be an almost infinitesimal bulge on the horizon. They reached it 2 days later, a land of rolling green hills, scarred here and there with ragged outcroppings of rock, and a land that climbed slowly and steadily higher as it went into the north. They camped that night in a little vale. The fore of it was white with the bones of woods goats that had tarried too long the fall before and got caught by an early blizzard. There was still flesh on the bones, and scavenger rodents scuttled among the carcasses, feasting. "We'll split up now," he told the others the next morning. He assigned each of them his position, Steve Schroeder to parallel his course 30 miles to his right, Gene Taylor to go 30 miles to his left, and Tony Chiara to go 30 miles to the left of Taylor. "We'll try to hold those distances," he said. "We can't look over the country in detail that way, but it will give us a good general survey of it. We don't have too much time left by now, and we'll make as many miles into the north as we can each day. The woods goats will tell us when it's time for us to turn back." They parted company with casual farewells, but for Steve Schroeder, who smiled sardonically at the bones of the woods goats in the vale and asked, "Who's supposed to tell the woods goats?" Tip, the black, white-nosed mocker on Lake's shoulder, kept twisting his neck to watch the departure of the others until he had crossed the next hill and the others were hidden from view. "All right, Tip," he said then. "You can unwind your neck now."
"Unwind? All right," Tip said.
Then, with a sudden burst of energy which was characteristic of the mockers, he began to jiggle up and down and chant in time with his movements.
"All right, all right, all right, all right."
"Shut up," he commanded. "If you want to talk nonsense, I don't care, but don't say all right anymore."
"All right,"
Tip agreed amiably, settling down.
"Shut up if you want to talk nonsense. I don't care."
"And don't slaughter the punctuation like that. You change the meaning entirely."
"But don't say all right anymore," Tip went on, ignoring him. "You change the meaning entirely."
Then, with another surge of animation, Tip began to fish in his jacket pocket with little hand-like paws.
"Tip hungry, Tip hungry."
Lake unbuttoned the pocket and gave Tip an herb leaf. "I notice there's no nonsensical chatter when you went to ask for something to eat." Tip took the herb leaf, but he spoke again before he began to eat, slowly, as though trying to seriously express a thought.
"Tip hungry. No nonsensical."
"Sometimes," he said, turning his head to look at Tip, "you mockers give me the peculiar feeling that you're right on the edge of becoming a new and intelligent race, and no fooling." Tip wiggled his whiskers and bit into the herb leaf.
"No fooling," he agreed.
He stopped for the night in a steep-walled hollow and built a small fire of dead moss and grass to ward off the chill that came with dark. He called the others, thinking first of Schroeder, so that Tip would transmit to Schroeder's mocker.
"Steve?"
"Here,"
Tip answered, in a detectable imitation of Schroeder's voice.
"No luck."
He thought of Gene Taylor and called,
"Gene?"
There was no answer, and he called Chiara.
"Tony, could you see any of Gene's route today?"
"Part of it,"
Chiara answered.
"I saw a herd of unicorns over that way. Why, doesn't he answer?"
"No."
"Then," Chiara said, "they must have got him."
"Did you find anything today, Tony?" he asked.
"Nothing but pure andesite, not even an iron stain."
It was the same kind of barren formation that he, himself, had been walking over all day, but he had not expected success so soon. He tried once again to call Gene Taylor.
"Gene, Gene, are you there, Gene?"
There was no answer, and he knew there would never be. End of Episode 8. Episode 9 of Space Prison by Tom Godwin. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Space Prison, Episode 9. The days became weeks with dismaying swiftness as they penetrated farther into the north. The hills became more rugged, and there were intrusions of granite and other formations to promise a chance of finding metal, a promise that urged them on faster as their time grew shorter.
Twice he saw something white in the distance. Once it was the bones of another band of woods goats that had huddled together and frozen to death in some early blizzard of the past, and once it was the bones of a dozen unicorns. The nights grew chillier, and the suns moved faster and faster to the south. The animals began to migrate, an almost imperceptible movement in the beginning, but one that increased each day. The first frost came, and the migration began in earnest. By the third day it was a hurrying tide. Tip was strangely silent that day. He did not speak until the noon sun had cleared the cold, heavy mists of morning. When he spoke, it was to give a message from Chiara.
"Howard, last report. Goldie is dying. Pneumonia."
Goldie was Chiara's mocker, his only means of communication, and there would be no way to tell him when they were turning back.
"Turn back today, Tony," he said. "Steve and I will go on for a few days more."
There was no answer, and he said quickly,
"Turn back! Turn back! Acknowledge that, Tony!"
"Turning back,"
the acknowledgment came.
"Try to save her."
The message stopped, and there was a silence that Chiara's mocker would never break again. He walked on, with Tip sitting very small and quiet on his shoulder. He had crossed another hill before Tip moved, to press up close to him the way mockers did when they were lonely and to hold tightly to him.
"What is it, Tip?" he asked.
"Goldie is dying,"
Tip said.
And then again, like a soft, sad whisper, "Goldie is dying."
"She was your mate. I'm sorry."
Tip made a little whimpering sound, and the man reached up to stroke his silky side.
"I'm sorry," he said again. "I'm sorry as hell, little fellow."
For 2 days, Tip sat lonely and silent on his shoulder, no longer interested in the new scenes, nor any longer relieving the monotony with his chatter. He refused to eat until the morning of the third day. By then the exodus of the woods goats and unicorns had dwindled to almost nothing. The sky was a leaden gray through which the sun could not be seen. That evening he saw what he was sure would be the last band of woods goats, and shot one of them. When he went to it, he was almost afraid to believe what he saw. The hair above its feet was red, discolored with the stain of iron-bearing clay. He examined it more closely and saw that the goat had apparently watered at a spring where the mud was material washed down from an iron-bearing vein or formation. It had done so fairly recently. There were still tiny particles of clay adhering to the hair. The wind stirred, cold and damp, with its warning of an approaching storm. He looked to the north, where the evening had turned the gray clouds black, and called Schroeder.
"Steve, any luck?"
"None," Schroeder answered.
"I just killed a goat," he said. "It has iron stains on its legs. It got at some spring farther north. I'm going on to try to find it. You can turn back in the morning."
"No," Schroeder objected. "I can angle over and catch up with you in a couple of days."
"You'll turn back in the morning," he said. "I'm going to try to find this iron. But if I get caught by a blizzard, it will be up to you to tell them at the caves that I found iron and to tell them where it is. You know the mockers can't transmit that far."
There was a short silence. Then Schroeder said,
"All right, I see. I'll head south in the morning."
Lake took a route the next day that would most likely be the one the woods goats had come down, stopping on each ridge top to study the country ahead of him through his binoculars. It was cloudy all day, but at sunset the sun appeared very briefly, to send its last rays across the hills and redden them in a mockery of the iron he sought. Far ahead of him, small even through the glasses and made visible only because of the position of the sun, was a spot at the base of a hill
that was redder than the sunset had made the other hills. He was confident it would be the red clay he was searching for, and he hurried on, not stopping until darkness made further progress impossible. Tip slept inside his jacket, curled up against his chest, while the wind blew raw and cold all through the night. He was on his way again at the first touch of daylight, the sky darker than ever and the wind spinning random flakes of snow before him. He stopped to look back to the south once, thinking, "If I turn back now, I might get out before the blizzard hits." Then the other thought came. "These hills all look the same. If I don't go to the iron while I'm this close and know where it is, it might be years before I or anyone else could find it again." He went on and did not look back again for the rest of the day. By mid-afternoon, the higher hills around him were hidden under the clouds, and the snow was coming harder and faster as the wind drove the flakes against his face. It began to snow with a heaviness that brought a half-darkness when he came finally to the hill he had seen through the glasses. A spring was at the base of it, bubbling out of red clay. Above it, the red dirt led 100 feet to a dike of granite and stopped. He hurried up the hillside that was rapidly whitening with snow and saw the vein. It set against the dike, short and narrow, but red-black with the iron it contained. He picked up a piece and felt the weight of it. It was heavy. It was pure iron oxide. He called Schroeder and asked, "Are you down out of the high hill, Steve?" "I'm in the lower ones," Schroeder answered, the words coming a little muffled from where Tip lay inside his jacket. "It looks black as hell up your way." "I found the iron, Steve. Listen, these are the nearest to landmarks I can give you." When he had finished, he said, "That's the best I can do. You can't see the red clay except when the sun is low in the southwest, but I'm going to build a monument on top of the hill to find it by." "About you, Howard?" Steve asked. "What are your chances?" The wind was rising to a high moaning around the ledges of the granite dike, and the vein was already invisible under the snow. "It doesn't look like they're very good," he answered. "You'll probably be leader when you come back next spring. I told the council I wanted that if anything happened to me. Keep things going the way I would have. Now, I'll have to hurry to get the monument built in time." "All right," Schroeder said. "So long, Howard. Good luck." He climbed to the top of the hill and saw boulders there he could use to build the monument. They were large. He might crush Tip against his chest in picking them up, and he took off his jacket to wrap it around Tip and leave him lying on the ground. He worked until he was panting for breath, the wind driving the snow harder and harder against him, until the cold seemed to have penetrated to the bone. He worked until the monument was too high for his numb hands to lift any more boulders to its top. By then it was tall enough that it should serve its purpose. He went back to look for Tip, the ground already 4 inches deep in snow and the darkness almost complete. "Tip!" he called. "Tip! Tip!" He walked back and forth across the hillside in the area where he thought he had left him, stumbling over rocks buried in the snow and invisible in the darkness, calling against the wind and thinking, "I can't leave him to die alone here." Then, from a bulge he had not seen in the snow under him, there came a frightened, lonely wail. "Tip cold! Tip cold!" He raked the snow off his jacket and unwrapped Tip to put him inside his shirt next to his bare skin. Tip's paws were like ice, and he was shivering violently, the first symptom of the pneumonia that killed Mocker so quickly. Tip coughed, a wrenching, rattling little sound, and whimpered, "Hurt! Hurt!" "I know," he said. "Your lungs hurt. Damn it to hell, I wish I could have let you go home with Steve." He put on the cold jacket and went down the hill. There was nothing with which he could make a fire, only the short half-green grass already buried under the snow. He turned south at the bottom of the hill, determining the direction by the wind, and began the stubborn march southward that could have but one ending. He walked until his cold, numbed legs would carry him no farther. The snow was warm when he fell for the last time, warm and soft as it drifted over him, and his mind was clouded with a pleasant drowsiness. "This isn't so bad," he thought, and there was something like surprise through the drowsiness. "I can't regret doing what I had to do, doing it the best I could." Tip was no longer coughing, and the thought of Tip was the only thing that was tinged with regret. "I hope he wasn't still hurting when he died." He felt Tip still very feebly against his chest then, and he did not know if it was his imagination, or if in that last dreamlike state it was Tip's thought that came to him, warm and close and reassuring him. "No hurt, no cold now. All right now. We sleep now." Part 3. When spring came, Steve Schroeder was leader, as Lake had wanted. It was a duty and a responsibility that would be under circumstances different from those of any of the leaders before him. The grim fight was over for a while. They were adapted and increasing in number, going into big summer and into a renaissance that would last for 50 years. They would have half a century in which to develop their environment to its fullest extent. Then big fall would come to destroy all they had accomplished, and the Gurns would come to destroy them. It was his job to make certain that by then they would be stronger than either. He went north with 9 men as soon as the weather permitted. It was hard to retrace the route of the summer before, without compasses, among the hills which looked all the same as far as their binoculars could reach, and it was summer when they saw the hill with the monument. They found Lake's bones a few miles south of it, scattered by the scavengers as were the little bones of his mocker. They buried them together, man and mocker, and went silently on toward the hill. They had brought a little hand-cranked diamond drill with them to bore holes in the hard granite and black powder for blasting. They mined the vein, sorting out the ore from the waste and saving every particle. The vein was narrow at the surface and pinched very rapidly. At a depth of 6 feet it was a knife-blade seam. At 10 feet it was only a red discoloration in the bottom of their shaft. "That seems to be all of it," he said to the others. "We'll send men up here next year to go deeper and farther along its course. But I have an idea we've just mined all of the only iron vein on Ragnarok. It will be enough for our purpose." They sewed the ore in strong rawhide sacks and then prospected, without success, until it was time for the last unicorn band to pass by on its way south. They trapped 10 unicorns and hobbled their legs, with other ropes reaching from horn to hind leg on each side to prevent them from swinging back their heads or even lifting them high. They had expected the capture and hobbling of the unicorns to be a difficult and dangerous job, and it was. But when they were finished, the unicorns were helpless. They could move awkwardly about to graze, but they could not charge. They could only stand with lowered heads and fume and rumble. The ore sacks were tied on one frosty morning, and the men mounted. The horn-leg ropes were loosened so the unicorns could travel, and the unicorns went into a frenzy of bucking and rearing, squealing with rage as they tried to impale their riders. The short spears, stabbing at the sensitive spot behind the jawbones of the unicorns, thwarted the backward-flung heads, and the unicorns were slowly forced into submission. The last one conceded temporary defeat, and the long journey to the south started, the unicorns going in the run that they could maintain hour after hour. Each day they pushed the unicorns until they were too weary to fight at night. Each morning, rested, the unicorns resumed the battle. It became an expected routine for both unicorns and men. The unicorns were released when the ore was unloaded at the foot of the hill before the caves, and Schroeder went to the new water wheel where the new generator was already in place. There, George Craig told him of the unexpected obstacle that had appeared.
"We're stuck," George said. "The aluminum ore isn't what we thought it would be. It's scarce and very low grade, of such a complex nature that we can't refine it to the oxide with what we have to work with on Ragnarok."
"Have you produced any aluminum oxide at all?" Schroeder asked.
"A little. We might have enough for the wire in 100 years if we kept at it hard enough."
"What else do you need? Was there enough cryolite?" he asked.
"Not much of it, but enough. We have the generator set up, the smelting box built, and the carbon lining and rods ready. We have everything we need to smelt aluminum ore, except the aluminum ore."
"Go ahead and finish up the details, such as installing the lining," he said. "We didn't get this far to be stopped now." But the prospecting parties, making full use of the time left them before the winter closed down, returned late that fall to report no sign of the ore they needed. Spring came, and he was determined they would be smelting aluminum before the summer was over, even though he had no idea where the ore would be found. They needed aluminum ore of a grade high enough that they could extract the pure aluminum oxide. Specifically, they needed aluminum oxide. Then he saw the answer to their problem, so obvious that all of them had overlooked it. He passed by 4 children playing a game in front of the caves that day, some kind of a checker-like game in which different colored rocks represented the different children. One boy was using red stones, some of the rubies that had been brought back as curios from the chasm. Rubies were of no use or value on Ragnarok, only pretty rocks for children to play with. Only pretty rocks? Rubies and sapphires were corundum, were pure aluminum oxide. He went to tell George and to arrange for a party of men to go into the chasm after all the rubies and sapphires they could find. The last obstacle had been surmounted. The summer sun was hot the day the generator hummed into life. The carbon-lined smelting box was ready, and the current flowed between the heavy carbon rods suspended in the cryolite and the lining, transforming the cryolite into a liquid. The crushed rubies and sapphires were fed into the box, glowing and glittering in blood-red and sky-blue scintillations of light, to be deprived by the current of their life and fire and be changed into something entirely different. When the time came to draw off some of the metal, they opened the orifice in the lower corner of the box. Molten aluminum flowed out into the ingot mold in a little stream, more beautiful to them than any gems could ever be, bright and gleaming in its promise that more than 6 generations of imprisonment would soon be ended. The aluminum smelting continued until the supply of rubies and sapphires in the chasm had been exhausted, but for small and scattered fragments. It was enough, with some aluminum above the amount needed for the wire. It was the year 152 when they smelted the aluminum. In 8 more years they would reach the middle of Big Summer. The suns would start their long drift southward, not to return for 150 years. Time was passing swiftly by for them, and there was none of it to waste. The making of ceramics was developed to an art, as was the making of different types of glass. Looms were built to spin thread and cloth from wood's goat wool, and vegetable dyes were discovered. Exploration parties crossed the continent to the eastern and western seas.
salty and lifeless seas that were bordered by immense deserts. No trees of any kind grew along their shores, and ships could not be built to cross them. Efforts were continued to develop an inorganic field of chemistry, with discouraging results, but in 159 the orange corn was successfully adapted to the elevation and climate of the caves. There was enough that year to feed the Mockers all winter, supply next year's seeds, and leave enough that it could be ground and baked into bread for all to taste. It tasted strange, but good. It was, Schroeder thought, symbolic of a great forward step. It was the first time in generations that any of them had known any food but meat. The corn would make them less dependent upon hunting, and, of paramount importance, it was the type of food to which they would have to become accustomed in the future. They could not carry herds of woods goats and unicorns with them on Gurn battle cruisers. The lack of metals hindered them wherever they turned in their efforts to build even the simplest machines or weapons. Despite its dubious prospects, however, they made a rifle-like gun. The barrel of it was thick, of the hardest, toughest ceramic material they could produce. It was a cumbersome, heavy thing, firing with a flintlock action, and it could not be loaded with much powder, lest the charge burst the barrel. The flintlock ignition was not instantaneous. The lightweight porcelain bullet had far less penetrating power than an arrow, and the thing boomed and belched out a cloud of smoke that would have shown the Gurns exactly where the shooter was located. It was an interesting curio, and the firing of it was something spectacular to behold, but it was a weapon apt to be much more dangerous to the man behind it than to the Gurn it was aimed at. Automatic crossbows were far better. Woods goats had been trapped and housed during the summers in shelters, where sprays of water maintained a temperature cool enough for them to survive. Only the young were kept when fall came, to be sheltered through the winter in one of the caves. Each new generation was subjected to more heat in the summer and more cold in the winter than the generation before it, and by the year 160 the woods goats were well on their way toward adaptation. The next year they trapped two unicorns, to begin the job of adapting and taming future generations of them. If they succeeded, they would have utilized the resources of Ragnarok to the limit, except for what should be their most valuable ally with which to fight the Gurns, the Prowlers. For 20 years, Prowlers had observed a truce wherein they would not go hunting for men if the men would stay away from their routes of travel. But it was a truce only, and there was no indication that it could ever evolve into friendship. 3 times in the past, half-grown Prowlers had been captured and caged in the hope of taming them. Each time they had paced their cages, looking longingly into the distance, refusing to eat and defiant until they died. To Prowlers, as to some men, freedom was more precious than life, and each time a Prowler had been captured, the free ones had retaliated with a resurgence of savage attacks. There seemed no way that men and Prowlers could ever meet on common ground. They were alien to one another, separated by the gulf of an origin on worlds 250 light-years apart. Their only common heritage was the will of each to battle. But in the spring of 161, for a little while one day, the gulf was bridged. End of Episode 9.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.